Welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. This month we speak with Craig Cahoon about the public sphere and Sunil Abraham about digital privacy. I'm your host, Ian Cook. What do you believe in? Do you believe in gods, and do those gods inform the way you discuss ideas, politics, or society with others? Or maybe you believe in machines and computers, mechanical minds to be trusted, to be fair and honest in ways that, well, us humans can't. Maybe it's those that inform the way that you debate. Well, in this month on Online Gods, belief is the central thread that ties our show together. Those of you who are regular listeners can close your ears now for the next 30 seconds, but those of you who aren't should know that Online Gods is a podcast that explores how going digital is changing the contours of public debate. Each month we speak with a scholar about a key concept or idea. In the second half then we speak with an online god, a mover or shaker of our digitally enabled age, based in India or amongst the diaspora. The podcast is part of a wider project on digital dignity run by Sahan Udba out of LMU. You can find us online at 4digitaldignity.com, Twitter 4 with a number 4 at Digital Dignity, and Facebook 4 with a number at Digital Dignity, or you can also drop us an email at onlinegodspodcast@gmail.com. If you do like the show, then please go on iTunes and give us ratings. It's what helps other people find us. Now, if I sound a little bit different this month, it's because I'm not in the usual studio that I use in CU in Budapest, but rather in the greatest city in India, which is Mangalore in Karnataka, for those of you who don't know. However, before I left, I sat down with Craig Cahoon in that very studio to talk about the public sphere. For those of you who don't know him, Craig is a sociologist who is currently president of the Berggruen Institute. Before that, he was a director of the London School of Economics, and before this, he was a university professor of the social sciences at New York University, among many, many other things. He's worked a lot on questions of the public sphere, nationalism, and religion. And it's his interview, which is up next. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome Craig to the podcast.
It's nice to be here, Ian.
Wonderful. Let's dive straight in. Now, maybe I'm glossing a little bit, but the received wisdom goes a little bit something like this. There's been a gradual secularization of the public sphere. Religion has become less and less important in public discussions, but in recent years, it's made a resurgence, maybe shaping more and more our common conversations. But things aren't quite so simple as this, are they?
No, and it depends how far you go back. The public sphere became more religious before it was secularized. Mm-hmm. So it's not simply as though in the old days, everybody was all the time religious. In the old days, there may have been cathedrals and there may have been very important large-scale public rituals, but there were also lots of people who were ignoring religion and going about their daily lives. There was an intensification of religion in the early modern period in a couple of phases, from the Protestant Reformation or again in the 19th century. Lots of what we think of as old religious traditions, like the pilgrimages, like Lourdes, are from the 19th century. And these were intensifications in which ordinary people were called upon to behave a little bit more like clergymen or like monks and to be demonstrating their seriousness about religion. And it's in relation to that that we then begin to have a secularization. The secularization, moreover, is hardly complete, and it's very uneven. Europe secularizes more than the U.S. Within Europe, France secularizes more than Poland or Ireland. And so it's an uneven geography of secularization. And I think the last thing to say about it is that there are different issues involved in this. There's, do you go to church on Sunday? Do you believe in God? But there's also, do you accept there being a state church and an official government role? And many people think there ought to be an official government role, even though they think they don't have to participate in it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so maybe it's a question about time or maybe even the temporality of concepts. But a term you hear used a bit now in academic discourse is post-secular or post-secular age or post-secularization. I was wondering, why do you think that sort of term can be used now? What made people want to use it? Maybe can you unpick it a little bit for us?
So I need to be clear that I'm not a fan of the term post-secular. Yes. It comes about because people accept a secularization story, and then they say, but look, it's been reversed. Now we're not so secular. There are a variety of new religious movements, and there are new adherents or newly prominent adherents to old religions. Mm-hmm. And fair enough, there's truth to this. But here's what seems to be misleading. First, were we ever so completely secular? Second, who's the we? From the point of view of an American, religious engagement remained pretty high throughout modernity mm-hmm. compared to in Germany or in France. And so I'm not so sure that thinking about the new evangelical movements in America or the religious right wing in politics as post-secular quite gets the point. It's a renewed religious engagement. It's changed. The other thing about it that all post concepts share is it's not naming the new phenomenon. It's just saying what it's after, like postmodernism. Okay, mm-hmm. but what is it? And here I think there are lots of different things being lumped together. There is the fact that Islam has become prominent in Europe and on the world stage. Islam isn't post-secular. It's a religion that wasn't getting very much attention prior to the last few years and now is getting a lot more attention because of migration, because of international politics and terrorism, because of conflict in the Middle East. The same story for the evangelical movement and religious right among Christians, that this is not all theologically new or post-secular, but it became newly political in the last 30 or 40 years. So what a thinker like Jürgen Habermas, the German social theorist, is on about when he uses the phrase post-secular is that the public sphere as he knew it didn't give much of a place to religion, and now it does, because now you have to acknowledge that there are these American right-wing Christians, and you have to acknowledge that there are Muslims, and you see religion. Moreover, finally, for Habermas himself and for others, there's the thought that maybe religion mattered in some hidden ways, even when we thought we were being secular. We borrowed some metaphors, some language from the Bible. Religious life gave us some inspirations for secular ideas. So talking about salvation could be part of an entirely religious story about saving your soul, but it could become the basis for a political story about saving the country from something. And so religion could be a source of inspiration for movements that were not specifically religious.
That's wonderful. And maybe I want to bring in media a little bit here, particularly what role do you think media, especially new media, plays in what we don't want to call a post-secular age, but whatever we want to call this moment, what role does media and new media play?
Let me make a connection to what we were talking about before and say maybe we should just call it a secular age, but say that religion has some new roles in this secular age. Uh-huh. I would follow the Canadian thinker Charles Taylor in that, who says, look, it's a secular age. It's been a secular age for some time, and what that means is that there are more and more areas of our lives where we don't expect religion to govern everything. Our business dealings, science and technology, when we go to the hospital and so forth. That doesn't mean that nobody's religious. Religion is changed by that secular age, and people will pray for the market to go up, but they also will choose their investments on other criteria. In that context, there's a lot of searching for spiritual meaning. And here we see the place of religion and of other kinds of spiritual seeking coming. And here we see media mattering in a lot of ways because it connects up people. So people from different countries, different religions, different backgrounds can much more readily learn about thoughts elsewhere. Small groups can stay connected at long distances with the media. So it's different from a time when there was a dominant story told by state television or a small number of networks that stabilized a sort of mainstream story and gave relatively little attention to those things that were on the fringes. The new media open up the possibility for there being some channel, some podcast, some social media network in which each of these things can be the main story. And in fact, you can stay within the orbit of one of those stories. So you can listen to evangelical radio, watch evangelical TV, go to evangelical websites and subscribe to social media networks that are entirely evangelical and stay within that to a large extent and look at other issues in the world through that lens, through that media circle. And at the same time, somebody else who's searching can look around and say, oh, I see what the evangelicals are saying. Now, that's not for me. But over here, I see what these New Age people are saying about crystals. That seems more like me, and I'm going to learn more about it. I'm going to follow the links.
That's really interesting. And it's, I'm glad you brought up this sort of diversity of or even like maybe little pockets that people can find within this the public sphere, especially the digital public sphere. With this sort of fragmentation and so on, is public reason possible? What is this, you know? Yeah.
Yes, certainly it's still possible. Is it harder? Yes, because public reason depends on engaging each other across our lines of difference. Mm-hmm. Having a public sphere that you can use the term A about, that is singular, like the national public sphere, the Hungarian public sphere, the French public sphere, requires there being connections among all these different groups. And the media trend has been to give them each the ability to develop their different networks and understandings of the world and to have weaker connections. Now, I don't think it's impossible, but I think it takes some work. And the old institutions that used to build those connections don't work very well to do it now. Political parties used to do that because in a democratic society, they often had to build a coalition among several different groups to be able to have a majority. Political parties have been largely broken in recent years and have failed to do very much of that. And that's contributed to polarization, not just in religious terms, but in other terms. So I think that there's a challenge to figure out what kinds of institutions will connect us up to each other across these differences.
And then within that, then, I mean, one of the things we're exploring within this project is the idea of dignified debate. It is a space for dignity. Right now in India, there's a federal state election coming up, and I'm in some WhatsApp groups and following things on social media, and it's pretty brutal, like the sort of discussions, like very crude and often violent sort of language and memes and so on being made. So with the sort of, and I'll problematize the term digital age, but you know, with this sort of internet-enabled discussion, is there a possibility for dignified debate, do you think?
Sure. One would want to ask, is any national context different? Was India different already? And my impression is that there has been for a long time a mixture of dignified and sophisticated debate, and you can read the Economic and Political Weekly, and very brutal assertions in the context of electioneering and other social media, and that goes on orally with oratory in front of a crowd. So it's not surprising that it goes on in the new media. The new media do, however, in some ways encourage people to feel that the usual social inhibitions don't apply. If you're speaking to people, you can look in the eye. You don't say quite the same things that you can say in this abstracted context of a tweet or a some other kind of social media posting. And I don't think that's unique to India, but I think it's powerful in lots of settings that this can go on. It also can be very quickly magnified. So there may be only one or two people in a village with a certain opinion, but there are 10,000 villages, and those one or two people in each village tweeting that can quickly magnify each other. And then if you bring in the possibilities of technological magnification, using robots to retweet, then you have something that creates a new sort of seemingly ubiquitous reality. Everybody is using bad language. Everybody's being brutal. Everybody's being nasty. And really, it's not everybody. It's a handful of people originating those messages, but they're getting retweeted a lot, repeated a lot.
Ruslan, my final question relates to this, like I suppose, like retweeting or maybe even the silence of the digital public sphere. Because if we were sitting face to face, you know, in a saloon, having this sort of classical discussion, we do. We see each other in the, we look at each other and we respond to each other. But there's a temporal aspect here to
you know, just putting stuff out, putting lots and lots of stuff out, not even needing a response necessarily,
yeah.
and you can keep on putting it out.
That's yeah. right. So it can be magnified and multiplied enormously, and it has an instantaneous effect. And I think there are a couple of other things to say. Remember the print media. It's not just face-to-face versus the new digital media. Yeah. Print media stabilized and slowed down the circulation. They enabled the circulation, but not at the kind of speed that the new media have. The other thing is the visual in the new media, that pictures circulate, not just words. And they circulate across language groups, something that matters in India with lots of different languages, but matters internationally. You can see the picture of the police beating the protester instantly, decontextualized, and interpret it for yourself as it goes around, or by the interpretation that it's sent with, because somebody tweets, "This is X. And here's the picture." You say, "Okay, I can see it. It's real," and it's emotional because of the picture.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for this answer and for all your others. It's been really great having you on the podcast.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Now, I think one of the many interesting things to come out of that interview was Craig's suggestion that religion remains the source of inspiration for ideas in seemingly secular parts of our lives. Something similar came up to this actually when I was talking with Sunil Abraham in the next interview, when we were speaking about the faith that we place in abstract systems, how we need maybe something to put our belief in. Now, Sunil is the executive director of the Center for Internet and Society. Aside from this, he founded Mahiti in 1998, an organization that reduces the costs and complexity of information and communication technology for the voluntary sector, primarily for the use of free software. He has managed projects for the UNDP and the International Fund for Agricultural Development, and he's also written extensively on issues relating to the internet, privacy, and data. I went to visit him at the Centre for Internet Society in Bangalore, and we met in the basement, which I hope will be quiet, but because Bangalore is Bangalore, there's construction work going on close by, so you might hear hammers and sawing at times, and you can just at one time catch an employee briefing an intern very, very strictly in the room next door. I hope that doesn't disturb the conversation too much. We're going to speak about digital privacy, and among other things, Sunil refers to GDPR, which for those of you who don't know is the General Data Protection Regulation, a piece of EU law on data protection and privacy. I started off our conversation by asking him what he would say to someone who said they didn't care about their data being used by companies, as they considered it fair price for getting to use software or applications for free.
Attitudes around data protection are very similar to attitudes around tobacco use. Most people that use tobacco are fully aware of the various consequences that come with tobacco use. But because each of them have an uncle who is 85 and has smoked all his life and still doesn't have cancer, they use that type of anecdotal data points to justify their continued behavior. The only way they would be scared is if they have a doctor come up to them and say, "Hey, what's that on your X-ray?" So this is precisely why the solution for data protection in a population cannot depend on individual awareness. The history of regulation starts with the regulation of the meatpacking industry. And the argument there was that since customers can't see what is in the sausage, you need health inspectors to go to the factories and inspect the meat that is going into the sausage. So the principle of caveat emptor is not working because the customer cannot know and therefore cannot protect his or her interest. So this is precisely why in data protection, we need more proactive paternalistic state action, because we can never hope for a day when individuals will wise up and act in a way that protects their interest. And even if a health inspector or a privacy inspector was put into the factory inside Facebook, they wouldn't be able to understand the algorithm that produces various effects on the platform. So it is even escaping that early understanding of regulation that regulators themselves can understand what is going on. So you have to depend on much more hard lines, such as an absolute prohibition on centralization of data, or an absolute prohibition on the use of biometrics. You'll have to opt for those types of measures in order to get the societal outcomes that you are hoping for. If you leave it up to market activity, then you will end up in a situation where the very same person who said, I don't care about giving my personal data, will say, hey, Facebook stole my election and you did nothing about it. So the parallel is from the nuclear industry, which is once things happen, then it's often too late and the harms are irreversible. With a bad sausage, you'll have a bad tummy, but you should be fine in a couple of days. But with your personal information compromised on a public internet, there is no reversing that situation.
Mm-hmm. So for those of us who don't know much about data protection in the Indian context, what law, if any, exists and what's in the pipeline?
India has a very minimal data protection law. It exists in our IT Act or Information Technology Act. Section 43A of this Act is a data security provision. But in 2011, the government issued subsidiary regulation or rules, and these rules were expanded outside the scope of the mother provision to include various elements of data protection, such as transparency, consent, purpose limitation, and so on. So the mother provision, 43A, and the subsidiary rules together form what is our existing data protection regulation. Unfortunately, if you compare it with something like the GDPR, what is very obvious is we don't address all the 9 privacy principles comprehensively. And many of the protections that we provide only apply to sensitive personal data or information, such as biometrics, political affiliation, health data, financial data. So the whole Cambridge Analytica episode in India is most probably completely legal, because the minimal data protection law that we have doesn't go far enough to address those types of challenges.
A few years ago, I was at a presentation by Nandan Nilekani. For those people who don't know, he's one of the co-founders of the Indian outsourcing and IT company Infosys. And he's also one of the brains behind India's ADA scheme, which is a unique identification number, which is supposedly an opt-in scheme, but in reality, anyone who wants to do any sort of interaction with the state starts to use it. And at the time when people were questioning him in the audience, he was saying that he was sort of championing the apolitical nature of technology and technologists. Like it's a savior from the messiness of politics in India. This was his suggestion. And now, right now, most people are probably aware of the Facebook data leaking scandal. There's also been quite a few scandals relating to ADA, the unique identification number as well. So I'm wondering, with these issues in mind and other things that have gone on, do you think that the idea that technology-enabled schemes are free from political experience, is this now a dead idea?
It's a myth that persists in the population, partly because very rich and powerful entrepreneurs that have made their fortunes off the internet contribute to the perpetuation of this myth. And really, it is a particular form of techno-utopianism. And in one of the articles that I write, that I've written about the Aadhaar project, I have tried to break it down into the creed of the techno-utopian. So the first thing that the techno-utopian will say is that more technology is better than less technology. And that would mean that having 100,000 X-ray machines at an airport instead of 10 will make it 1,000 times or 10,000 times safer. The second thing they will say is that more expensive technology is better than cheaper technology. And the third thing they will say is later technology is better than older technology. And the fourth thing they will say is more complex technology is better than simple technology. And if you take the example of photographs as a primitive biometric technology and DNA profiling as a very advanced biometric technology, DNA profiling is more expensive, it is more complex, it is also more recent compared to photography as biometric technology. But when a photographer is developing a negative, the photographer is almost never worried that accidentally his or her image has ended up on the negative. That's an error that very rarely happens in photography. But as part of standard hygiene in a DNA profiling lab, the first thing that the machine operator will do is compare her own biometric profile to the biometric profile that has been generated by the machine, because accidentally DNA material could have fallen into the machine. So the appropriateness of a particular technological solution is not obvious just by looking at abstract qualities of the technology. That is just examining the technology in isolation. The moment you bring technology into a human system, you have even more complications. People like the folks behind the Aadhaar project, they've only had experience designing information systems for within the perimeter of a firm. They have never had any experience working with nation states. And that's why the Aadhaar project is now failing today, because they've made certain assumptions that you can only make within a firm that don't hold true at all for a nation state. And this is why Barack Obama very famously said that you can't fix the problems of governance using mobile apps.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the failings of Aadhaar at the moment?
To begin with, they have decided to go with biometric technology. Biometric technology is surveillance technology. It helps the state identify the citizen even when the citizen does not want to be identified. So, in other words, biometrics is what I'd like to call remote, covert, and non-consensual identification technology. If you contrast that with something like smart cards allow the citizen to identify himself or herself to the state only when they want to do so. If they want to avoid identification, they can always flush the smart card down the toilet. So you can't take a technology which has surveillance potential and then try and say, through law, I will limit the use cases that the technology can be put to. That's a flawed approach, because at some point or the other, people will try to exploit the other use cases that are enabled by the technology. The second big failure is that it is a centralized network topology. If we've learned anything from the internet as far as resilience goes, it is that you must have a decentralized or at least federated network topology. And the centralization of the Aadhaar architecture brings with it a whole range of issues. The third important point to raise is this question of skin in the game and also black boxed decision making. So the determination of the state is depending on a machine which is a black box with proprietary software from foreign agencies in it to answer the question whether I'm a citizen or not. And therefore, the state is avoiding responsibility. There will be nobody, no human that I can point to and say, you have treated me unjustly. The only thing I can blame is this black box biometric algorithm. So you could design information systems where there is a chain of trust and every actor in that chain of trust can be identified, and when things go wrong, blame can be apportioned in some kind of logical fashion. When you design systems like that, those systems are less likely to be gamed or compromised, because there is skin in the game and all these actors will pay a price if things go wrong. If, on the other hand, you just centralize it into an opaque unit, then everybody will just blame technology, and no humans and no institutions will pay the price when things go wrong.
And do you think there's an appetite, maybe in the Indian population, but also wider, to trust machines more than individuals in the state because of, you know, past experiences?
Again, it's a question of the myth that has been constructed around machines. What is often not clear at all in popular discourse is that the machine and the code has an architect and an author. Often these machines are still controlled. They are not completely autonomous. And given the history of the sensors that are used to feed information into these machines, some of the biases or failings of the machine are baked right into the DNA of the technology. So these dimensions of the machines that we're dealing with are often underplayed in popular discourse. So people try to place faith in the new god. So there's a type of crisis as far as spirituality is concerned. Throughout the world, the old gods, their roles are shrinking, and they are no longer used to explain the bulk of phenomena that we encounter. Increasingly, religion is used to explain a very finite set of human activities and phenomena. But the attitude of humans has not changed. It isn't the case that overnight, as a whole, our planet has shifted to a scientific temper. So there is this innate religiosity. And since we no longer can publicly tell each other that we believe in gods, we now say that we believe in science, or we say we believe in technology. And it is that unquestioning, uncritical faith that we place in technology that allow the techno-utopians to take us for various rides. Because all they have to say is that this is science and this is technology, and then the general population has a lot of faith in what they can do.
So it's interesting you raised this question, and it ties into the main project idea that we're looking at, which is in terms of digital dignity. You know, what is it to have dignity online? So with specifically to do with privacy and protection, what would like dignity online entail?
I can bring it back to the other project. When a person pays for their meal at a restaurant using their smart card or credit card with a chip in it, then they give the card, and usually the steward doesn't touch the person as part of that transaction. But if you go to the account of the Unique Identity Authority of India, or if you go to any situation where biometrics are being used, you will see that if the biometric machine does not pick up the data from the finger, the operator or the official is touching sometimes a child, sometimes a woman, on some occasions an aged person, on other occasions a disabled person. It could be a sexual minority, like a transgender person. So there is some technology that has dignity baked into the design of the technology. And there is other types of technology that does not have dignity baked into the design of the technology. So with that parallel, you can look at any internet service and interrogate it from the perspective of dignity. Today, most of the social media giants are being faulted because the world has very lately discovered that their business model is surveillance capitalism. Now, I'm not against capitalism per se. As a 45-year-old, I find myself getting increasingly conservative as day goes into day. But the question is, could that be done in a fashion with greater dignity? So you could have a system where, as a diabetic, I'm happy to disclose to the advertisers that I'm diabetic and then get advertising that targets me as a diabetic without Facebook actually having to monitor when I'm injecting insulin into my body. Because as far as the advertisers are concerned, they just need to know that I'm diabetic. So a different contract can be engineered between advertisers, social networks, and users of social networks. If it is clear that the only way we can pay to use these social networks is through personal information, then it's only a question of making it very clear. It could be a quiz that I answer every month, which allows me that gives me an opportunity to authorize Facebook to allow for certain advertisers to target me. So that's a completely different vision from a vision which is, I'm going to keep all your call records, I'm going to keep all your SMS records, because through that I might be able to guess that you are filling up on your insulin supply from so-and-so chemist. It's a very different method of inferring this data from me, but I might be quite willing to actually tell you quite directly that I would like to be targeted by the following advertisers when I'm on your platform, and based on such reasons. That we have chosen the options with the least human dignity baked into it is what is disappointing about internet and ICT today.
Thank you so much for this answer and for all your other answers and for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks again for having me.
Hope you enjoyed the interview with Sunil. As he was speaking to me, I remembered when I entered India, I had to have the border control officer push my fingers down really hard onto the fingerprint reader, which is used at the border control, because it seems my fingerprints are not strong enough. So I can really identify with his comments about the physical aspect of an undignified type of data collection. I mean, he really pushed my finger really hard after I've not slept for I don't know how long, 20 odd hours, and was really angry at me. Because somehow my fingerprints weren't being read by the system. But apart from this, what I really enjoyed about the conversation with him is that he raised really reasonable and practical objections and then solutions to these objections. I'm thinking especially when he's talking about state intervention. Now, someone with an anarchist heart like myself probably always shudders a little bit when there's talk of heavy state intervention. But certainly at the moment, I can't think of any better way to stop the continuing data disasters which are occurring and probably continue to occur into the future. Anyway, that's it from us this week. A reminder, you can find us online at 4digitaldignity.com, and again, a small appeal to give us some iTunes love if you can. We get a load of listeners, but we hardly have any reviews, so it's always good to help get new people in by leaving some positive comments. Of course, you can feel free to write negative comments as well. We'll just track you down with our new friends who are experts on data security, and nobody will ever hear from you again. Anyway, thanks again for listening. Ta-ra!
Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online ARPOL, funded by the European Research Council, starting grant agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahana Udapa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. This podcast, like all the podcasts, is brought to you in collaboration with the HOW Network for Ethnographic Theory, my personal favourite network for ethnographic theory. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.